we will certainly bring about catastrophic level of global warming and mass extinctions across the planet, which may or may not include human beings. The likelihood of us successfully addressing that problem or other problems that we face while also threatening nuclear extermination as a matter of national policy, which becomes deeply ingrained in our national psyche, the level of violence that we accept and normalize, it becomes prestigious through the prestigious institutions that I want to talk about. That prestigious, normalized violence becomes a block to us doing anything positive about anything. That's one of the reasons that I'm here today. I think we also have to be aware that extinction, while we think of it as an all-or-nothing thing, the ecologists might emphasize the patchwise processes that occur. I live in a dry state. I don't know whether there's any more bears in the Sandia Mountains. Global warming and climate change may have already gotten rid of them. We don't know. This is review. I'm going to skip over this, except I want to point out that in the Department of Defense and its military contractors, there's overall a ratio of about one federal employee to two contractors. That's because of all the people in the military. In the Department of Energy and its subsidiary, the NNSA, the ratio is about one fed to 20 contractors. So the Department of Energy is the most privatized federal department, and within that, the nuclear weapons enterprise is the most privatized part of DOE. And you've all heard about how expensive this all will be if these modernization plans go forward to their conclusion, which I think the chances of that are quite remote. Bill gave a very, very good talk on the nuclear weapons complex and the military-industrial complex generally. This is an old map of sort of the nuclear weapons complex. The white sites are DOE sites, the remaining DOE sites. You can see there are two of them in my state. Our ratio of nuclear weapons spending to state product is about 11 times greater than the next state, which is Tennessee. The two red sites are centers of contracting and administration. I want to focus now more on focusing in on the labs, on the Department of Energy part of this business. This is a history of funding. There's a divergence of those lines there because some include administration and some don't. And then here, that flat green one estimates 2% inflation during the future year national security program. But you can see that the spending level is quite high relative to the Cold War, and that it has taken off in the Obama period. This is the nuclear weapons budget of the Department of Energy broken down by site in then-year dollars. And you can see here something we'll talk about a little bit more, which is the takeoff in the three laboratories in the decade following the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. They became much more richly funded entities after the CTPT. This spike here, I don't really fully understand. It's contracting out of Washington. And this new entity here is the corporate combination of Y-12 and Pantex. The contractors are already complaining that they can't freely move money from site to site, that they need to have congressional approval to do that, which is annoying to them. This is the same graph in 2014 dollars, which shows that same spike started during Clinton and continued in the first part of the Bush administration. All right, I thought that maybe it'd be a good idea to go over a short, abridged history of the weapons lab since the Cold War to give you an idea of some of the issues involved. And I, like Bill, I'm tempted to go all the way back to the beginning, because sitting in our office thinking about this talk, it fell in on us, on my wife and coworker and myself, how the nuclear weapons labs have repeated the same themes through history. The slogans change. There's novelty in administration, but there's an enormous continuity. The DNA of the nuclear weapons labs has remained remarkably constant. The first thing that jumped out at me was that the people in charge of the Manhattan Project knew 17 months before the Trinity test that Germany was on the road to defeat. So Los Alamos was founded the same month as the Russian victory in Stalingrad. Project Alsos went through Europe, and the information began to come back. By the time they interviewed Joliot Curie, it was all clear, but that was when the work truly speeded up. It was starting from March 1944, it was understood by General Groves, as well as the leading scientist at Los Alamos, that this was a project about post-war domination. There was a dinner at the Chadwick's house in Los Alamos that Joseph Rotblat was at and wrote about subsequently, where General Groves said, this is about controlling Russia after the war. That was in March of 1944. All the information about how there wasn't a German bomb program was all in hand by the end of 44, and that's when Joseph Rotblat quit. So the two lessons that you get from this and much more history is that deception is baked into the DNA, both for internal morale purposes as well as for funding, for CYA, for everything. And the second is that the bureaucracies once set in motion cannot absorb new information from the real world. So we have a changing national security situation today, but the nuclear weapons complex and the military-industrial complex cannot absorb this information. It will be decades, if ever, before they could ever. They will only absorb things if it's profitable. And they have built now a system of such inordinate profitability that they can't learn. They can't manage, they can't finish projects, and they can't learn. The salaries at the weapons laboratories are among the most highly guarded secrets out there. I can give you a few hints. There's about 1,000 people at each weapons laboratory that make on the order of $350,000 a year. This is much more than cabinet officials or members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. These are not senior scientists. These are mid-career people. The average compensation at the weapons laboratories is on the order of $180,000. That includes pension and health care and so forth. The directors of the laboratories make $1.5 million or even more. The uppermost management is also very highly compensated. No one can make this kind of money in the real world. And so they're locked into a situation where they can't change. They can't work on things that they would have to compete with people at universities or anywhere else in society. They're locked in. And I think that a lot of the activists don't really get this when they think, oh, well, we'll get them to work on some green project, or we'll get them to do something that will verify a nuclear weapons-free world or something like that. They forget things like conflict of interest. They forget how much, they don't really know how much money they're making, and they don't know how little expertise of any broad sense is present in these laboratories. Manuel Garcia, who worked at Livermore, is probably, he said, you can't change these to something else any more than you could change a battleship into a bicycle. You have to melt it down and you can make a bicycle, you know, lots of bicycles, but you can't change them. Now, this has all taken a lot of time. There's only like 3 minutes left, something like that. The most important thing from this long series of slides, which I'm not going to be able to show you, is that This is sort of a little history of the Cold War in the weapons laboratories. What we did not understand in the beginning, but we do understand now, is that the Cold War was only over on one side. And that's why I put in a little, as Bill did also, about PNAC. There was an end run around reform. And there have been phases of breakout from government control. One person in government remarked to me that the laboratory's basic business plan is to substitute themselves for the government decision-making process, control all the information that could make it possible for government to reassert its authority, and to blackmail the government if any attempt is made to change either of the first two conditions. The blackmail is accomplished through the annual stockpile certification letter and through a broader suite of political activities in which they engage. So at any time there might be 100 or 200, there were up to 400 long-term change of station assignments from the DOE laboratories in DOE headquarters, making policy, reading speeches, writing, you know, reviewing the nuclear posture review. You could have a meeting, interagency meeting about nuclear weapons policy, and sit it down in a room with one guy from Livermore, one guy from Los Alamos, and another guy from Los Alamos, and it's because they're all there on a change of station assignment taking federal roles. It goes beyond lobbying to simply replacement of government. And this is so confusing that even Senator Feinstein did not know that the directors of the weapons laboratories are contractors. She thought they were federal. So we've had a long-term breakout in phases since the Cold War, which has been facilitated by political deals that were entered into with good intentions, but the result has been catastrophic. The nuclear weapons live through their institutions, whether those institutions are Lockheed Martin or an ICBM base or weapons laboratories. And the health of those institutions and the funding of those institutions is very closely associated with their political power and their influence over policy and the strength of the power of their ideology. So when you make a deal that gives more money or even an unlimited amount of money to the weapons laboratories in return for a policy goal, in today's privatized environment, as opposed to the Kennedy administration, when it seemed to work, then you're really asking for trouble. There have been about 55 studies of lab reform over the last 20 years, and there's no effective reform that has taken place. So we'll skip all of the study groups, my ideas for reform here. Okay, the good news is that this system is in crisis, from incompetence and collapsing project management, from collapsing workload. Small victories on the margin have created a looming workload crisis, which the laboratories are very conscious of this. In fact, the weapons complex as a whole is. If you don't have warheads to upgrade at Pantex, they will have to start taking them apart. That's not joking. The resource issues that our society faces are opportunities for us, as are the management failures. We should not insulate the weapons complex from the effects of its management failures by offering unlimited funding streams. I don't see the possibility of a single-issue disarmament movement in the United States because of the intensive co-optation of NGO and civil society activity in the United States by the philanthropic foundations that are closely associated with the State Department. I don't see that happening. We are not that politically educated or organized at this point in time. However, I do see the possibility of a broader-based resistance movement based on issues of dignity, justice, and bread-and-butter financial issues that really cut very close to home for a lot of people, of which nuclear weapons can piggyback on.
And we continue with Bob Alvarez on lateral proliferation could trigger a nuclear holocaust.
As some of you know, in the spring of this year, The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference will take place. It occurs every 5 years, and now it's been agreed upon to do this indefinitely every 5 years at the United Nations in New York City. And the treaty was essentially adopted and enacted into force in 1970, and it was essentially an interesting product of consensus amongst the Cold War rivals between Russia or Soviet Union and the United States. And it has three basic pillars to it. One is the nuclear weapon states that were identified as official at that time: the United States, Soviet Union, Russia, United Kingdom, France, and China would undertake good faith efforts for the complete disarmament, nuclear disarmament, and general disarmament. The second pillar was that countries could have the right to seek to develop the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and that the third pillar was that those who did would forswear developing nuclear weapons would agree to undergo international safeguards and security. Now, there are other provisions of this treaty which we're now growing to regret. For example, Article 5 approved of peaceful nuclear explosions. Some of you may not remember that. Something that India did in 1974, declared it a peaceful nuclear explosion, but it didn't pass the LAAF test. The other is Article 10, which gives nations the, quote, inalienable, unquote, right to develop uranium enrichment and reprocessing. These are very proliferation-sensitive technologies. Nuclear power in and of itself is inherently a dual-use technology that can be used to develop nuclear weapons. It was recognized as such very early on. Most people don't realize that the first major generator of nuclear powered electricity was essentially a dual-purpose reactor operated at the Hanford site between 1963 and 87. It was the largest producer of nuclear electricity in the 1960s, and it was also producing plutonium for the U.S. nuclear weapons program. We also have reprocessing. This is an overhead shot here of the Purex reprocessing plant in Yongbyon in North Korea. And we also have enrichment of uranium involving centrifuges and other technologies. I'm going to give you a quiz on this one. I apologize. I should have put this in a more understandable form. But this particular table addresses the issue of how much plutonium is being generated by commercial nuclear power plants or nuclear power plants worldwide by design, by reactor type. The key to nuclear nonproliferation is not access to knowledge, it's access to the actual explosive materials. This is the essential safeguard that is required. The secrets of how to make nuclear weapons are not so secret anymore. The technologies, while some of them are hard to come by, can be obtained. But it's the actual materials, especially plutonium, highly enriched uranium, and in certain cases, uranium-233. These are what are known as fissile materials or nuclear explosive materials. What this graph basically shows is that roughly one out of every five reactors in operation right now that are generating nuclear power worldwide are based on original designs to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. The top one, the PHWR, which is pressurized heavy water reactor, this was a design, it was a workhorse for the United States nuclear weapons program at the Savannah River site. Most of these reactors are in Canada. They're called CANDU reactors. But this particular reactor provided India with its plutonium for its first nuclear weapons. It's providing Pakistan with its plutonium for nuclear weapons. And if you see the numbers here, it is a very, very efficient plutonium producer. It's producing about twice as much weapons-usable plutonium than our commercial nuclear power plants, pressurized water, boiling water reactors. The RBMK beneath that is essentially a graphite-moderated water-cooled reactor that are operating in Russia right now. This is the so-called Chernobyl-style reactor. They stole this design from the United States, and we were operating 9 such reactors at the Hanford site. To produce plutonium, we produced about 67.4 metric tons using this particular design reactor. Then following down, you have the pressurized water reactors and the boiling water reactors, which really make up the great majority of reactors worldwide. And then you have the gas-cooled reactors. These are graphite-moderated gas-cooled reactors. These are reactors that fueled the British, French, North Korean, and Israeli nuclear weapons programs. They are generating electricity. They are part of the mix of global nuclear power. As you see this number here at the very, where it says global annual plutonium discharge in red, nuclear power plants worldwide, there are about 427 of them. They are generating roughly 100 metric tons of plutonium a year, weapons-usable plutonium a year. And when all is said and done, when this spent fuel is discharged from a reactor, it's, as you may know, is very highly radioactive, very difficult to handle. But after a period of several hundred years, what's really left over is the plutonium. And this becomes a long-term concern. What will we be doing with all this plutonium that we've been generating worldwide? The major challenges we face here, well, first of all, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They've tested three nuclear weapons so far and threatened to unravel the nuclear non-proliferation regime of the Far East. Iran, where, as you know, we're in the process of trying to negotiate an agreement, we being five nations led by the United States, to somehow come to an agreement that would limit the degree and extent of uranium enrichment that Iran would develop in order to provide a nuclear fuel for its research program and its power program. I think we should not in any way discount the Chernobyl and Fukushima nuclear disasters. I think they play a very big role. They play a very, very big role in how we deal with nuclear dangers, and we have to start to bring nuclear safety much more to the forefront and recognize that these are type of reactors that deal literal body blows to entire nations. We have nuclear weapon states outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, such as Israel, India, Pakistan, Democratic People's of Republic of Korea, all operating in unstable regions with long histories of conflict. Pakistan right now is producing more nuclear weapons than any other nation in the world. They're spending somewhere between $2.5 to $3 billion a year on making nuclear weapons. We've had basically a glacial pace in terms of U.S. and Russia nuclear arms reductions and the stalling of multilateral nuclear agreements such as a fissile material cutoff treaty. We have the risk of terrorist threat from unsecured fissile materials. President Obama has made it a high priority for nuclear security of these materials. But if you look very carefully at what we're talking about here in terms of preventing people from getting their hands on these materials and making bombs and committing acts of malice, what we are doing is cleaning up after the Atoms for Peace parade. The United States distributed a huge amount of highly enriched uranium worldwide in order to foster development of nuclear energy. We sent it to places like Congo in Katanga province, where we still have some HEU there, and we haven't yet been able to retrieve it. We have the total discriminatory nature of safeguards and security under this treaty between nuclear weapon states and non-weapon states, which is a sort of do as I say but not as I do, which is a source of inherent tension. The nuclear weapon states, the United States, the UK, Russia, France, and China, really are steadfastly opposed to undergoing the same level of scrutiny of their programs as those entities that we suspect might want to be developing nuclear weapons. And then at the same time, the United States is sending really mixed signals to other countries pursuing proliferation-sensitive technologies. In 1970, the year that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty entered into force, then chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, Glenn Seaborg, estimated that by the end of the 20th century, there would be 1,000 reactors dotting the American landscape. There would be a commensurately large number of reactors worldwide, that the world would exhaust its supplies of uranium, and that by this time, the U.S. reactors alone would require 1,600 tons of plutonium to sustain their future. As some of you know, it takes 4 to 6 kilograms. The amount of plutonium that was detonated over Nagasaki was 6 kilograms. We've sort of greatly reduced that since then, but 4 to 6 kilograms. So at that time, he was basically promoting the idea that we would have literally at least 1,600 tons of plutonium floating through international commerce. And think about just a small, tiny fraction of that amount of plutonium somehow being diverted and stolen. We still are pursuing these technologies, albeit in a lower level. For many years, the United States was one of the principal supporters of what they call the closed nuclear fuel cycle. This was based, again, on the whole notion that we would have such spectacular nuclear power growth that we would run out of uranium, and therefore we had to establish another form of nuclear fuel, namely plutonium. And the idea here was that the irradiated fuel would be removed from the reactor after a certain period of time. It would be sent to a chemical separations plant where the plutonium and uranium would be extracted. The plutonium and uranium would be, quote, recycled and put back into reactors, and except these would be a different kind of reactors known as fast reactors, because these reactors, in order to have significant quantities of plutonium in them, need fast neutrons to generate the energy necessary to provide electricity, as opposed to the reactors we now have, which are based on thermal neutrons or slow neutrons. I attended a hearing once when I first got started about a fast reactor, and a gentleman from the Atomic Energy Commission was being questioned about what would be happen if you lost the coolant. The coolant of these reactors is basically liquid sodium. And if you know anything about liquid sodium, if it comes into contact with air, it basically spontaneously combusts. And so this senator asked this government witness, well, what would happen if you had a loss of coolant in one of his reactors? And his reply was, well, we might have a rapid energetic disassembly. This idea has been kicked around and is still kicked around. The United Kingdom has pretty much quit. They are stuck with a bunch of plutonium that they don't know what to do with. France is sort of limping around with a large amount of excess separated plutonium with no credible disposition. Japan is reeling from the Fukushima disaster, and it remains to be seen whether they'll really be able to establish a plutonium economy. And Russia is still waving the flag and the only one operating a breeder reactor right now. The rationale for using this type of reactor has changed because, you know, it's obvious that we have not run out of uranium, and nuclear power growth projections were underestimated by an order of magnitude. And so it was then thought about, well, these reactors would help us reduce the amount of waste that would have to be disposed of by transmuting them into less troublesome isotopes. In 1996, while I was in the Energy Department, we asked the National Academy of Sciences to look at this. We asked the National Academy of Sciences to look into this, and they reported that if everything worked, using the spent fuel from the existing nuclear power fleet, it would take about $740 billion in 2014 dollars and take 150 years to accomplish the transmutation of the plutonium. But it still goes on. The open nuclear fuel cycle is what we pursue right now, which is that we irradiate the spent fuel, we store it, and over time, if things work out, which they haven't for the last 50 or so years, we would dispose of this in a geologic repository. Assuming a large capacity worldwide of nuclear power, we will have reached about 20,000 metric tons of plutonium worldwide. This gives you an idea of global nuclear power perspective. The third graph, which is Japan, you have to understand that all those reactors are shut down right now. But this tells you a lot about where nuclear power is and who has the most and where things stand. This is a graph that shows you the accumulation of spent fuel inventories by the year between 1990 and by the year 2030. And so that spent fuel will accumulate approximately 5,000 metric tons of plutonium worldwide. This is another graph that gives you an idea of the age of the reactors, because as you see, the majority of the existing reactors are between 27 and 34 years old, and being able to backfill that is going to be an enormous challenge. And despite the claims about this rather spectacular growth of nuclear power, it really remains to be seen. This is essentially a projection by the IAEA of nuclear growth worldwide, and really the one takeaway I have from this is that the top part of the bar graphs basically tell you that China is a place where nuclear power growth is expected to be significant. But beyond that, how much nuclear power will China develop really is depending on a lot of factors. This is a graph about the United States nuclear weapons program. I publish a regular column in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And this shows the budget projections from fiscal year 2014 to the year 2020 of the weapons activities program of the Energy Department. How many of you, what percentage of the Energy Department's budget do you think goes for actual energy activities? What do you think? Any thought? About 15%. Two-thirds of the Energy Department's budget is for babysitting nuclear weapons, maintaining the nuclear arsenal, and cleaning up the mess that was created by generating these weapons. That's what two-thirds of the Energy Department's budget about. What this shows you here in terms of the colors of this, once you start to, with the exception of these turquoise little bands, that's transportation. They're about, we spend about $250 million a year to move around nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons parts. If you take that little blue bands out and you, everything above the red is to keep the lights on. We're looking at an antiquated, oversized infrastructure that is costing at least 40% of the annual budgets just to keep the lights on for the nuclear weapons production complex. One thing I did is I decided to ask myself, well, if this were a business, what would be the per unit cost of nuclear weapons if you looked at the costs of maintaining an average warhead on an annual basis? And I looked at what it was 30 years ago when we had a large number of nuclear weapons. We had about something like 23,000 nuclear weapons, and what we have now, which is 7,300 nuclear weapons. And basically, the number of nuclear weapons dropped by 300% since 1985. The per unit cost of nuclear weapons has increased by 500% over the same time period. So we're getting more bucks for the bang here. This is one of the big dilemmas, I think, that we have to come to terms with, which is the large excess stockpiles of plutonium that have no credible disposition. The bar graphs in green are those stocks of plutonium that have been generated for civilian purposes. The black is for nuclear weapons purposes. We are trying to get, we, the United States, are now trying to figure out a way to get rid of roughly 50 metric tons of excess plutonium that was part of our strategic nuclear stockpile. Basically, it's estimated to cost about $30 billion. Plutonium has a negative value. It has no inherent value. So anytime you use it as a fuel, you're losing money. It's like it's the economics of sunk costs. We are also pushing the technology envelope in a way that I think will make the world a more dangerous place. We're beginning to, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is in the process of licensing the initial development of a new form of uranium enrichment involving the molecular level separation through lasers, tunable dye lasers, of uranium. This is called Silex, and we're looking now at enrichment facilities that used to consume a footprint of around 30 acres for the building to something that could be put into a Costco warehouse that would have no really serious footprint that could be detected using national means. It would use far less energy, would not have the chemical signatures you would expect to find for an enrichment plant. Our Nuclear Regulatory Commission is refusing to perform a nonproliferation assessment of this technology and letting GE move forward. In the meantime, by the way, speaking of which, mixed signals, the Republic of Korea, South Korea, we have a bilateral agreement with South Korea for nuclear cooperation, and that agreement is expiring this year, and the big issue is the Republic of Korea wants to be able to develop and acquire reprocessing technology because their spent fuel inventories are increasing and the public's becoming restive and very unhappy about all this nuclear waste piling up, and they figure, well, we'll quote, solve the nuclear waste problem. The State Department, to its credit, is arguing that no, they should not be allowed to reprocess, and they consider these 123 agreements, they're under Section 123 of the Atomic Energy Act, that they consider the gold standard is for a country to agree with the United States to forego reprocessing and enrichment. In the meantime, in the Department of Energy's budget, we're spending $35 million to help the Republic of Korea develop reprocessing technologies. This is going on as we speak. This is an example of what we call no adult supervision inside the U.S. government. We have really serious unfinished business of nuclear arms control and disarmament, a fissile material cutoff treaty, which is a multilateral effort. The major nuclear weapon states, the five declared nuclear weapon states, have stopped producing fissile materials for nuclear weapons for quite a long time now. We just simply stopped. We've got so much we don't know what to do with. The one of the insane things about nuclear deterrence by the early mid-1980s was that nuclear deterrence was actually being explicitly described in the terms of the winner of a nuclear exchange would be the one that had the most nuclear weapons left over. The United States and the former Soviet Union and Russia, I think, engaged in a grave strategic error in overbuilding its nuclear arsenals, and these are turning into giant millstones around our neck. We haven't a clue of how to really get rid of them in any significant way, but we have to start doing this. The Obama administration has a policy, now that the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference is up, the Obama administration has a quiet policy that it will not dismantle any of the weapons that it retires from the New START agreement until a new refurbished nuclear weapons complex is established sometime in the 2030s. This is the message that the United States is sending to the rest of the world at the NPT Review Conference. Not only that, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported last year that the Department of Energy, National Nuclear Security Energy Agency, does not track the dates of their retired weapons. Can you imagine this practice happening in a grocery store? I mean, it isn't like, you know, some fancy thing to track the dates. And not only that, the GAO pointed out that the NNSA is quietly reinstating hundreds of warheads to the stockpile. The stockpile is actually growing, and we're not doing any adult supervision over this. In the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, it's not surprising that Pakistan, in particular, is playing a key role in trying to block this. In conclusion, there are several challenges that threaten to unravel the nuclear nonproliferation regime in regions of longstanding conflict, particularly the Far East and the Middle East. Many non-nuclear weapon states at the NPT review conference will protest and have protested the lack of progress being made by weapon states. There's no good reason why the United States cannot take down literally thousands of its nuclear weapons. It currently has about 60% of the total number of intact weapons that are not deployed. 40% have been effectively retired. But we are sort of in the business of hoarding. Some of you may be familiar with the term of the cargo cults. These were the primitive Stone Age people who encountered industrial societies in the 20th century in the Pacific, like Borneo and elsewhere. And the Japanese and the Allies eventually showed up mostly during World War II with airplanes, guns, metal, knives, mirrors, uniforms, boats, things that they couldn't believe. And then the war ended and everybody left, and anthropologists came back several years later and observed that some of these cultures were doing things like carefully preserving the runways, the docks. They had their religious leaders, their shaman or a priest, whatever you want to call them, conducting religious ceremonies in uniforms, stamping pieces of paper. And they were asked, well, why are you doing this? It's because the gods had come. And if we don't preserve this, they'll never come back. And they were called cargo cults. I contend that we are maintaining a very large and expensive cargo cult in our nuclear weapons program. I sort of go through a shopping list of steps that are needed to strengthen a non-proliferation treaty. I won't sort of go over all these things, but there are several things that can be done to sort of tighten that treaty. But I think it's important to recognize that this treaty is not the end-all to be-all. It really depends, I think, largely on the United States and the nuclear weapons states to demonstrate real serious commitment and leadership in eliminating nuclear weapons. Thank you.
And we conclude with Robert Parry of Consortium News on Ukraine and the human factor, how propaganda and passion can risk nuclear conflagration.
And I do want to pick up on something that Seth was talking about the issue of probability of nuclear war. And he mentioned that there was a greater chance for nuclear war at a time of crisis. And he said, I think very correctly, that that should drive us to want to reduce the possibility of these kinds of crises. It is, as we see, however, there is a tendency in the way the U.S. political and media system works these days to actually encourage or to try to create crises, certainly expand on them when they could be easily dismantled or diffused. And obviously a key point right now is Ukraine and how that's been handled. But before I get to that, I think it's important to talk about how, in my time in covering Washington, D.C. since 1977, often for mainstream publications, we've seen how the propaganda system can work in the United States and how it's become really quite clever the way it meshes between politicians and the media and how we've personalized so much of how we see world affairs. It's become a pretty clear point, I think, that one way to get the American people riled up about some foreign conflict is not to talk about the controversy or the difficulties in some distant place, but to demonize some ruler. And we've seen this work very effectively over the past 30-some years, 40 years since I've been around. Ronald Reagan demonized Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. He was, if you remember, Ortega was the dictator in designer glasses. We personalize it, make it kind of funny. We get people laughing, and then the propagandists can pull in the public and get them to go in the direction they wanted. We saw this with Noriega in Panama, the guy with waving his machete around. We saw this perhaps most determinedly with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who was, I think George H.W. Bush called him worse than Hitler. And then there were propaganda elements around those things. If you remember in the Persian Gulf War, there were the allegations about Iraqis taking babies off of incubators and killing them. These were essentially fabrications, but they touched the American people and got them into the right mood to go ahead for war. And we've seen this evolve as sort of a regular standard procedure. And now, of course, we're seeing it in connection with Ukraine around Vladimir Putin. And one might say that Mr. Putin makes himself a rather easy target sometimes for being demonized. But still, there's this element of ridicule and anger and hatred that often goes beyond what's actually happening. But it's a key way to get the American people to focus on a conflict in a way that gets them very emotional, gets them very angry, and gets them ready to fight. And so in the case of Ukraine, one of the curious things when I started covering this was that it struck me that it wasn't a very difficult issue to resolve. Basically, as actually Der Spiegel did a very good job of this recently in doing a chronology of how this crisis evolved, if you go back to November of 2013, you had a dispute involving President Viktor Yanukovych, the elected president of Ukraine. He had been toying with the idea of having an association agreement with the European Union. He was moving ahead on that, but then he was advised by his economic people back in Kiev that to abruptly terminate economic dealings with Russia, their next-door neighbor, would cost Ukraine $160 billion. So he told Chancellor Merkel that he couldn't go ahead at this point. He wanted to keep negotiating, but he had to sort of figure out how to fill this hole. Now, that doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that, it's the sort of thing that political systems are supposed to handle. Yes, some people might think, yes, go ahead. Some people might say, well, let's take our time. Let's see if we can work out a situation where we do business with Europe, but also with Russia. All that would seem kind of reasonable, I suppose. But it certainly upset some people in Ukraine, and especially in Western Ukraine, where they had ideas that they could become more part of Europe. Of course, people in Eastern Ukraine, the more ethnic Russians, wanted to maintain their historic relations with Russia. So there was this difference. And in the middle of this, as this political problem was playing out with the Maidan demonstrations, we suddenly see the United States, particularly some of our neoconservatives, jumping into it. We saw Senator McCain speaking to the protesters, speaking from a platform of one of the right-wing parties under a banner honoring Stepan Bandera, who had, for a while at least, during World War II, collaborated with Hitler. And McCain said, the American people are with you. America is with you. We saw the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, going out in passing out cookies. And we learned that she had been, in early February of last year, having a conversation with the U.S. Ambassador, Jeffrey Pyatt, about who would be the new leaders of the government. She favored someone named Yats. She says Yats is the guy. Yats, of course, turned out to be Arseniy Yatsenyuk. And then you saw the crisis get worse. You saw groups from organized often in the western part of Ukraine, some of them very far right, some of them even neo-Nazis, being trained and brought into Kiev, bussed in by the hundreds each day, to change what had been a more or less peaceful demonstration into something more violent. And that led eventually to increased death toll. There was a mysterious sniper attack, which we still don't know exactly who did it, but it was immediately blamed on Yanukovych and his people. And we saw these passions moving up. And it wasn't no longer just an issue of economics. It became sort of a morality play. And in the midst of this, as Yanukovych is essentially driven from power, he and his officials flee the country on February 22nd, then you see the United States moving in very quickly and declaring this the legitimate government of Ukraine. And you see Arseniy Yatsenyuk, Yats, becoming the prime minister. So obviously this has become a complicated issue, but it was one where the United States, U.S. officials, again, wanted to achieve something. You had people some of these neoconservatives who have survived inside the Obama administration. Some of them have actually gone ahead, and they certainly are supported by the think tanks, some of which we've talked about, and they are supported by much of the media. So suddenly the issue of Ukraine became a morality play. We had our good guys, we had our bad guys. Yanukovych was the bad guy. There was even a badder guy named Vladimir Putin. And this is, so instead of it being something that could be handled, where there could be some federalized system or there could be some arrangement where it could work out, we ended up with the United States and Russia facing off in what became known as Cold War II. And it began over something, as I said, that was not particularly difficult for a political system to handle, but it was brought into this propaganda structure. And it was brought in with the idea of turning Putin into something, as Hillary Clinton compared him to Hitler. And then there was talk about how he really had plans to sort of conquer Europe. He was going to take the Baltic states back and rebuild the Soviet Union. There's, by the way, no evidence of any of this. There's no intelligence. There's nothing that supports these claims. But this became conventional wisdom in Washington. Even Henry Kissinger, in an interview with Der Spiegel, said, why would Putin have been doing the Sochi Olympics, trying to show, spending $40 billion to show how much he wanted Russia to be part of the West and part of the world system, and then turn around and try to cause trouble in Ukraine? It made no sense. But it became groupthink, and Washington is well known for its groupthink. We've seen the groupthink work as it did back in 2002 and 2003 in terms of everyone believing there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and we saw the consequences. And we've seen this happen over and over again in Washington. It gets to these points about no adult supervision. It's sort of like it's almost like some kind of animal house where people have sort of they start having fun, and before you know it, things get out of hand and people start dying. The difference with Ukraine, however, is that it's on Russia's border. And that leads you to a very difficult possible situation, where if you have a situation where where the Russians feel under pressure, the Americans feel that they're on the right, there are two conflicting narratives. The American narrative is that the Russians are the aggressors, that they're the ones causing all the trouble. The Russian view is that the Americans have been pushing NATO closer and closer to their borders, that they're the ones under pressure. They're the ones being threatened. I'm told by one of my sources who has good ties in Moscow that the Russians are absolutely paranoid about the possibility of cruise missiles being placed somewhere in Ukraine. They were particularly worried about Sebastopol, their historic port on the Crimea. It was one of the reasons that they moved in when the Crimeans said they wanted out of Ukraine and annexed Crimea, so they could maintain Sebastopol. So you have these fears. You have these two sets of fears or two narratives, and they have the danger of putting these two countries at a point of making the next miscalculation. We've already seen how this works. There was someone apparently made a miscalculation and shot down Malaysian Airline Flight 17 last July 17th, which further aggravated this situation. The Americans immediately blamed it on the Russians. They blamed it on the Russian rebels and said that the Russian government had provided these missiles to shoot down the plane. I'm told by people from connections to the CIA that some analysts at the agency don't believe that to be the case, that they were basically opposing that as an argument. They could not find evidence that the Russians had provided those missiles. So, and they believe that it was some rogue element of the Ukrainian forces involved. Now, so it's still a mystery. We still don't quite know who did what, but instead of waiting for the facts, we jump to conclusions. And that again drove this narrative. It drove this idea that Putin was this very dangerous figure who had to be stopped at all costs. And you even saw magazine covers like Der Spiegel saying, "Stop Putin now." You saw him being presented as some kind of vampire. Someone showed me that even The Economist this month has Russia's Putin's war on the West. Now, Putin's view, of course, is sort of opposite. He thinks the West is at war with him. And when you have these two situations, it becomes sort of easier to understand how you get to nuclear war. Because you have two nuclear states. You have many people in Washington now talking very openly about arming the Ukrainian military. You have the Ukrainian military talking about attacking and fighting the Russians. And you have this support really across the American political spectrum. It's not just Tommy Friedman of the New York Times who's talking about this sort of thing. It's also Nicholas Kristof, who's considered kind of a humanitarian liberal. He did a piece last year about how what the Ukrainians need from us are guns. And to take on the Russians, to go kill the Russian bear, as you put it. So now you have the situation growing increasingly dangerous. And the possibility becomes that there be future miscalculations. There was, just a week ago, one of the senior officials of the Ukrainian government was speaking with Canada's CBC. And here's what he said. This is Ukrainian Deputy Foreign Minister Vadim Pristeko. He told Canada's CBC that Ukraine wants to have, quote, a full-scale war against Russia. Pristeko explained, quote, "Everybody is afraid of fighting with the nuclear state. We are not anymore in Ukraine. However dangerous it sounds," he said, "we have to stop Putin somehow." So when you get to that kind of passion and that kind of excessive language and that kind of dare the torpedoes approach, what you end up with is a situation where you could very easily slide into the next series of miscalculations and the next. And the Russians may feel that they are about to be attacked. And as Seth put it, I mean, if in those kinds of moments, it becomes more reasonable to expect you're going to be attacked. And so if you see a blip on the screen showing that maybe it's a nuclear bomb or a nuclear missile that's been fired at you, you're more likely to react. And vice versa. The Americans are going to be more tense about this because they know the Russians are feeling paranoid and are at risk. So what you encounter is that we create a situation where nuclear war is not something that is just an abstraction. It becomes something that could actually happen. What's been most distressing to me, I would say, about covering Washington during this period is that there's a cavalier, goofy quality to so much of what the journalists and the media are doing, and the politicians as well. Kind of a one-upsmanship. I can be more aggressive than you. I can, if you say you want to do this with the Russians, I'm going to do this with the Russians. And there's almost a bidding of tough talk and tough guyism and some tough galism too. I mean, it was Hillary Clinton who was the first one to start comparing Putin to Hitler this time. So I guess the point I'm trying to make and what I've been doing, what some of our work at Consortium News has been focused on in the last year or so, has been trying to write this story honestly, trying to tell it from both sides. It used to be a part of my profession that we believed, and sometimes it's not true, but we believed that there are always two sides of a story. And you're supposed to at least seek out the other side of the story and represent it fairly. Even if you don't like the people, you're supposed to represent it fairly. I used to cover death squads in Central America. I've interviewed Roberto Dobuson. I dealt with the Tontamakut in Haiti. I didn't like these people, but it was a case of always trying to hear what their side was and understand it. And that was the job, I thought, of a journalist, to present both sides of a story honestly. And by doing so, give the American people the chance to then reflect back onto their politicians with a full understanding of what's at stake. Not to be led, not to be corralled, not to be, the phrase that they like to use in Washington, a perception management. The point of what the U.S. government's been doing for so long now has been sort of captured in that phrase, perception management. They feel that that the job, especially after the Vietnam War, when the American people got kind of out of control, the idea of how do you bring them back into line with the policies of a more warlike position in the world, a more militaristic position. And so they set to work, and they set to work aggressively during the Reagan years. They brought in the CIA. Walter Raymond Jr. was the top propagandist at the agency. He was brought into the National Security Council. He set up interagency task force on how to, as they said, manage our perceptions. And they've done a pretty good job of it. And what's been also happening along those lines is that as the years have gone on, the American news media has increasingly fallen into line, increasingly become a force to project, to reflect that perception management strategy rather than to contest it. Not to provide the American people an objective, fair, honest, full accounting of what's going on, but to tell you what's necessary to get you to support what they want to do in the first place. And I have to say that one of the worst places for this, in this recent round anyway, has been the New York Times. The New York Times has been utterly disgraceful in how it has presented the Ukraine story. It is one-sided. You read these stories, they reek of bias. I could say the Washington Post has been no better. That's certainly true, but that's not saying much these days. The Washington Post has become essentially a neoconservative newspaper and promotes neoconservative views. And the New York Times has increasingly moved that way, too. And I kind of understand it as a journalist that you're always looking out for your career. You don't want to be out of step. You want to make sure you get that promotion. You don't get fired. You don't get put on the overnight desk, whatever they can do to us. So you play ball. But playing ball in a case like this, especially, it's bad enough to do it on Iraq or on Panama or on Grenada or on Nicaragua or some other sad country. But to do it now on the border of nuclear-armed Russia and to not understand the dangers that you're putting the world into and the American people into, it seems at some point your career is not that important.
And many thanks to Dale Lehman, who recorded all of the audio for this week's show. If you'd like to download this episode or any previous episodes, you can do so from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I don't know who's been spreading the word about Unwelcome Guests, but it's been very encouraging to see downloads going up in the last month or two. So, my heartiest appreciation. Oh, just like the